Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Joining me now by the wonders of technology from across the globe are the Mensa sisters from McAllen, Texas, Tim Lynch. What's going on,
hey,
Timmy?
Man, how's it going, buddy?
I've been worse, man. I got no issues. And joining me from someplace in the Midwest is Will Costantini. William, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. If you hear someone like coughing up a lung on the radio, it's not me. It's actually my dog. She's got kennel cough, so I may have to go on mute later. And unlike Tim, I'll remember to unmute.
Oh, really? We're going to play that card right away? Will, I think that... Say something again, Will.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Okay. And joining me now is a man who has virtual total recall, except when he's... I think his memory gets better when he drinks. Jeff Kenny. Jeff, how are you?
I'm good, Mac. Thanks.
Is that a fact? Does your memory get better with the ingestion of alcohol?
I don't remember.
The perils of sobriety.
Yes. Absolutely.
Now, Jeff and I were together on the East Coast last week at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. And I went over, I flew in, and ironed a shirt at Jeff's room, and then we went to a change of command, and pretty good time. Jeff, any thoughts before we start talking about General McKenzie and his interviews about the change of command at the 2nd Marine Division?
Well, just that it was like the first change of command we did 2 years ago when we went there. Where there's so many people I hadn't seen and talked to in such a long time that, you know, it was tiring. It was exhausting because we were awake till early in the morning, but I hardly drank because you just were talking so much. So, I mean, I saw everybody from Mastin Robeson Jr. who worked with me in Afghanistan 12 and 13 and Wayne Sinclair who lived in our neighborhood up there in Onifray housing and stuff, you know, 15,000
pound
head guy.
So Jeff introduces me to Wayne Sinclair. Now, I don't know Wayne Sinclair. And all Jeff keeps telling me is, hey, Mac, this guy's really smart. And so he finally introduces him to me at the bar at the O Club. And so I'm like, oh, my God, you're Wayne Sinclair. And he looks at me. And he said, and I said, I'm so fucking sick and tired of hearing about how smart you are. I said, are you really that smart? And he looked at me and goes,
he said, I don't know.
Yeah, he says, no. I said, well, shit, man. Kenny's been telling me you're the smartest guy in the world, right?
And so turns out he's an All Marine Radio aficionado, man. He must be smart.
Exactly. He must be smart. No, it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool watching Dave give up the division, but again, as Jeff said, bumping into a lot of people, and for me, I mean, I spent a lot of time back there in the last 2 years, so it was pretty cool. And I'll tell you though, the other interesting thing that happened for me was my son's now a company commander in the division, so he's like an adult Marine officer.
Yeah,
and so it was like rolling with him. And you're looking at your kid. It's like, whoa, he's like a professional now, and it was fun. It was fun, and so I enjoyed that part of it too. All right, let's. So Will, do you want to give us an update on your dog? What's going on with your dog?
Well, I was in D.C. last weekend, so I had her in a kennel, and last night when I got back from a poker game at 2:30 in the morning. She started coughing, and she was doing it all night, so I got to bring her into the vet this afternoon. So,
do you think she got COVID at the vet, at the kennel?
Hopefully she didn't get COVID. But she wasn't wearing a mask, so you never know. I don't think the other dogs were either.
The Let's so before we get going, we may never even get into the program today, just for the record. So tell everybody about your DC experience. You found it moderately disturbing, yes?
Yeah, I found it really disturbing, actually. So I got in there on Thursday, stayed till Sunday, and had dinner with some old friends and family and whatnot on Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. And the six people I had dinner with over the course of those 3 days had not been in a restaurant since pre-COVID. And the thing that got me is, you know, there's no traffic in Washington, D.C., which is unbelievable. The GPS routed me at 1730 on a Thursday. I was staying up in Crystal City, which is right next to the Pentagon. Right. And I had to go south towards Springfield, and it routed me at 1730 down 395. So my experience of 395 at 1730 is bumper to bumper, 3 miles an hour for about 40 miles. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And I look, and it shows no traffic. And so, all right, I went out on 395, and there was some traffic out there, but it was moving 70 miles an hour. I said, this is not right. And I figured out after talking to people there, Washington, D.C. is hunkered down for a vaccine and a cure because everyone in Washington, D.C. is getting paid. Federal government's paying, and all those contractors are paying. And now the rates there are different than here in Kansas. I think Fairfax County, Virginia, which is right up in there, has got a pretty high number of cases and a relatively high death rate in comparison. So you got that. So maybe there's some real facts there. But on the other side, just the stupidity. You walk in the restaurant, you wear a mask. You sit down, you take the mask off. The server comes to the table, you put your mask on. The server leaves, you take your mask off. So you're handling these masks 15 times while you're having dinner with your filthy hands that have been all over everything. I don't know. It was unnerving. And then, like, you go to the Lincoln Memorial, and you're there with six other people, which is unbelievable in the summertime. Right. And you go to the Marine Corps War Memorial, and there's, you know, 10 or 12 people there. And then you go to Arlington Cemetery, and the cemetery is closed.
Well, jeez.
I'm thinking, who's the jackass who closes Arlington Cemetery? And then we went out to the Naval Academy on Saturday morning, and like the chapel is closed. And if you've ever been to the chapel there, it's this huge domed structure. It just, the risk aversion, particularly by the military. Oh, the Marine Corps Museum was closed.
Fucked
and
up.
I sent an email to General Kessler. And he says, yeah, it's a state mandate and the Marine Corps, and we're trying to do something. I'm thinking the risk aversion of these military people is a long way from, you know, the USS Johnson at Lady Gulf. It's a long way. And I found it disturbing, you know. And just the stupidity of traveling. I don't know how you guys were, but you sit in the airport and none of the seats are blocked off. So you're sitting right next to someone, and then they call you up to board 10 people at a time. So you're 6 feet away. Then they say, okay, you can board. Now you get in line right behind each other. You're standing right behind someone in the jetway, and you sit down and the middle seat is open, but the guy is right in front of you and right behind you. It just, it's just stupid. It's just stupid. But I fear there's nobody pushing. And that Washington, D.C. local area, which has always been different than the rest of the country, I got no sense that anybody there is pushing to open the country and even just use you can't get past the second question again. It defies logic on what we're doing. If it's the Black Death, everyone should stay at home. If it's not the Black Death, let adults make informed decisions and run their own lives. So, it was bad.
All right.
It was good if you wanted to be an outdoor tourist. You could see all the memorials and everything, and there's no crowds. It was easy to get around, no traffic, easy to park.
Smithsonian? But other than that, were the Smithsonians all closed?
No, all that stuff is closed. But Lincoln Memorial, Vietnam, Korea, World War II, Martin Luther King, FDR. We drove around like the White House and the Capitol, and it's just easy to get around and park because there's no one there, which is odd.
Love that.
For D.C. in the summertime, to say the least.
Right.
And the worst part is Ira Hayes and Abraham Lincoln both had masks on.
Well, I'm not sure which one is Ira Hayes in the statue, so I couldn't tell.
I know. I have my book out.
Either, so.
No, they do. I've got my book.
In fact, not touching the flagpole.
I gave Jeff the book, right? The right. Investigating Ewo, Flag Raising in Myth, Memory, and Esprit de Corps. You can get it for free. By mistake, I was sent two of them, or maybe I ordered it twice. I'm not exactly sure, but I gave one to Jeff Kenny so he could memorize it, and I'm expecting him to recite it sometime soon. Now, one other thing I want to ask Will about, and he alluded to it a little bit ago, Will has become, I don't know if you become or you've always been a bit of a poker player. Have you become one, or were you always one?
First, I want to go back. The idea that you gave Jeff a book.
Yes.
That may be the third book in his library that he didn't steal from someone. So,
well, that's why I gave it to him. I gave it to him so he wouldn't steal mine.
It's a library. Okay. Without cards in my house. It's the honor system.
Right. Book. Yeah, exactly. Honor among book thieves. So let's talk about your penchant for poker, Will.
You know, I always sort of like watching it on TV years ago when it really kicked in like 2000. And I was in Vegas a couple of years ago, and me and Carrie used to go, and we'd sit and play the nickel slots and drink in the morning and smoke inside. And that was sort of our vacation. And so I actually said, let me go see if I can play. And they have these daily tournaments you buy in for about $60. And the first one, I was really nervous and I didn't get anywhere. And so I said, I got to try that again. And I ended up winning a tournament. So I was in for like 60 and I won $600. And then, so I said, all right, let me see how this goes. I came back here to Kansas and there was three casinos in and around Kansas City. And I just started playing on like Saturday afternoons or Sunday afternoons. And I really like it. It's, you know, there's math behind it. There's psychology behind it. But it's a place where you can be ultra competitive because everyone there is trying to get their hand in your pocket. And you can do the same thing while still having a good time, and it's enjoyable. And you get to small town like this, you get to sort of know the people that play. And I developed some friendships with people here about it. And so it's fun. And it's one of my hobbies now.
How about that? Yeah. For those of you who didn't, I always, you know, honestly, I'm a bit disturbed over the characters I see on TV that play poker when I go by that thing. Are you one of? Do you have like a costume that's very intimidating? So, I mean, do you have a persona? Have you gotten more tattoos? Talk to us about this.
Oh no, and it's funny because you find people from all walks of life. I know people here that are like multimillionaires that play low stakes. I know people that you can't believe that they're still not in jail that play. And there's, you know, retired people. There's young people. There's men, women, all races, creeds, colors, et cetera. And every one of them is trying to get your money. So it's good. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Can be dangerous, and I've seen people here that are obviously over their heads when they get in there. It's, you know, an adult gets to make their own choices.
Let me ask you a question. Do you how do I say this? Do you give, if you were to give any poker advice, what would it be?
If for someone who's never played,
yes,
I would do a couple of things. One is go on YouTube, and there's a bunch of people that put vlogs up there. I mean, they haven't lately because most of the casinos are closed, but you can, the mechanics of the game are very easy to learn. You know, the rules. But then get on YouTube and see how these guys explain through their thinking of it. And then you can play low stakes. Low stakes means you start a game with $200 or $300. You can learn the game. And then the second advice I would give is it's an interesting game because – while there's a bottom line to it, you can't be results oriented in the minute, you know, in that moment. You're good decisions, and a good decision means if you're a 90% favorite, you're always going to take that bet. But that means that 10% of the time you're going to lose. And you can't get worried about when you're in there for the 90% favorite and the cards don't come out in your favor. It makes you be patient and sort of moderate. And it's actually a good decision-making exercise. Because just like in the business world or the military world or anywhere else, you want to be on the good side of decisions. And sometimes good decisions have bad results. And on the other hand, you know, this is about probability. And probability owes you nothing. The fact that you're a 90% favorite 10 times in a row, you can still lose 10 times in a row with that. So I've seen people saying, well, it's got to be my time now. And they start making bad decisions, and then you spiral pretty quickly. So it's a good parallel for a lot of other things. But it takes easy to learn the mechanics, hard to learn the game and what other people are really doing. And the easiest way to get is experience is to watch other people, because if you get experience on your own, it gets expensive.
Got it. Any are either one of you two guys poker players? Tim, Jeff?
I'm not Mac, but I got to tell you, I was with Jeff back at his place in Lejeune, so it would have been in like mid-90s in one night, and he said to me, he goes, hey, which one of us do you think is going to end up, you know, retired in a casino trying to beat old men out of their retirement savings on a poker table. And I said, I don't know. He goes, I think it's going to be Will. I swear to God.
Come on.
Okay. I might've made that up. I mean, but that's hysterical though. I would have never, that would have been the last person I thought was going to end up in a casino playing poker all the time. It's like in one of those cheap cop novels, you know, the old FBI agent. That's cool.
Jeff, are you a poker player?
No, I'm not, you know, but I'll tell you, it's interesting listening to Will talk about it. You know, I mean, I like the movie, The Rounders, where John Malkovich, the Russian Teddy KGB, says, pay that man his money. So I imagine Will in there winning and some Russian dude saying, pay that man his money. You know, but that's about as far as I go in poker.
I've never played either, right? I've never played. Will, did you? So you just started playing when you and Kerry would go to casinos? You didn't play as a kid, or your dad wasn't a big?
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, we played as a kid. In fact, me and Jeff on the LST before we would pull into port on that deployment, we'd sit in Captain Ratliff's stateroom and played penny ante sort of poker. I don't know if you ever played or not, Jeff, but
well, no, you know, I was doing a piss test then. thank you, Will.
But all the lieutenants would be there in the CO stateroom.
Everybody didn't have their dick out was playing poker. So.
you know, we keep playing that penny nickel ante. But that's it's a very different game than the way this game is played. This game, right. Texas Hold'em, really wasn't around back then. I mean, it was, but it was not popular. Now this is the popular game, and then there's a variation of it that gets a little crazy as well. They can get big money called the Omaha. We didn't play anything like that back then. But so I mean, you understand what poker hands are, no matter what variation you play. But this game is different because of the way the cards come out. There's more psychology, and you learn how to attempt to figure out what other people have, because there's cards that are exposed. And as people are betting, you can try and divine what's in their hand. And it's an interesting part of the game, because there's deception associated with it as well. And you got to think through, you get to know people, you can, you know, there's no tells where the guy opens up the Oreo cookie kind of thing. But there are tells in the way people bet and do other things at the table that you can learn, and you can learn it against people you don't even know, because you've learned the game. And so once you know that, then you got to counterplay against that. So again, it's like military deception in some ways. You're trying to paint a picture to give people a false impression. You know, and if you play poker, you're playing 30 or 40 hands every hour. So you sit there for 6 hours, you get 200 and 300 iterations to try and paint this picture for people, and to figure out what they're doing to you as well. And some people are completely unaware of that, and typically they don't go home with a lot of money.
So you're collecting on these people all the time?
Well, not all the time, because, again, it's probability. Sometimes you get unlucky. Sometimes you were wrong.
Right.
You know, I like to think that I'm a moderately successful,
really,
at the game. So,
all right. No, I agree with Tim. I would not have thought you to be a poker player, and so I'm a bit taken aback as well.
And he's playing the serious tables. It's not like he can wait for the old guys to get drunk. I don't think people playing at those tables drink.
Do they drink? Do you drink while you play
sometimes they do. And again, you get to know the player profile, the people around you. And there are some people that will come into the casino and have a few drinks, and you're fighting to get on that table. Because you know what's going to happen. And if you go to a casino, I mean, it's not now, because it's different now. It's only 5 people at a table. But, you know, 6 or 8 months ago, you go in on a Friday or Saturday night, and there'd be people in there having a good time, having quite a few drinks. And you could see the guys that you knew in there maneuvering around the poker room to try and get on those tables, because they know how to take advantage of people like that.
Sadly, interesting. Interesting. What is so when Kenny would get dealt a card and he would yell, "Aw, shit," what would that mean? Would that mean he's an emotional Italian, half Mick, that can't control himself? Or is that part of Jeff Kenny's deception?
Well, on the ship, it was very unlikely that he was intoxicated.
Right.
So it'd be tough to
obey. No drinking on the ship.
That's because
it would be
pilots.
Much harder to get a
pilot.
Read.
You would be.
All right.
Yeah, I don't remember Jeff sitting in on those games, and if he did, that means because I made a mistake and didn't have him busy doing some shitty job because he was a junior lieutenant. So
let's. I'm curious. Does anybody know General McKenzie?
Yeah, we know him. Me and Will know him.
Yeah,
Will especially.
Yeah, he was a company commander in 3-8. He was a CEO of India Company when I was the XO of Lima. And then he didn't go on that deployment with us, Jeff. No, he didn't. Craig Tucker.
Craig Tucker took the company from him.
Yeah. So I met him there. And then when I was a 3 and 1-2, I think he was a CO 1-6 or 3-6, one or the other. Right. So they were, when we got back from the med, they were the next in the shoot. So we sort of did the outbriefs with them. And then when he was the MILSEC for General Conway, I was up in the joint staff, and Petraeus was in Baghdad, and he used to send a letter to the SecDef every week that I would be able to intercept, and I would go up and give it to General McKenzie or Colonel McKenzie then, so he could give it to the commandant, so the commandant would know what Petraeus had said before he had to go down into the tank and meet with the SecDef. So I've known him off and on. He actually, when I came back from Egypt, he got me a job in PPNO. So I've known him pretty well. And then, funny, I actually hired his son when I was down in Florida. His son's a Naval Academy guy, got out, got an MBA, and I hired him down in Florida. And then the company, he left that job and came to this company in Kansas, and he helped me get an in to the company I work for here. So I know him pretty well.
Wow, I guess. Hello. What about
it's the Marine Corps. I mean, it's the Marine Corps, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
You know.
Not that big. What about, and especially if you hang around it for a while, Jeff, you know him?
Well, I he was in the 3-8 for a couple of months when I was there before he left. And he was, like Will said, he's the CEO of India Company, turned over with Craig Tucker. But then I ran into him. He was the CEO of the 22nd MU. When I went in as an advisor in Iraq, in the Anbar area, he was on his way out. So at Al Asad, that's where they were departing from. You know, that's where they were marshaling. The BLT was doing one thing. I don't remember what the command element, the MU, was doing. They were doing something else. And, people switch battle space pretty often in those days because of the units coming in and out. So I remember him turning over with partially with 3-3, and you know those guys, partially with 3-3, and partially with the Army Cav unit that was working out of Heat, and I saw him in the Ripper Chow Hall. You know, I said hello and everything, and not much after that. I had his intel officer working for me in IOC, he told me a little bit about 1-6, kind of what Will was saying. So I know of him and stuff, you know, and I didn't really know him that good. I would know him to say hello.
Got it. And Timmy, do you know him at all?
No, I don't. I don't know him.
I don't either. Let me just give you an impression. When he was at the Pentagon, he would wind up being the media briefer, and I thought he has this combination of intellect, a little bit of personality, and bluntness that I think works really well for him, and he uses that, and he's incredibly articulate, as this interview with David Ignatius points out. But the one thing that I is that bluntness and the edge that he has to him a little bit. I remember when there was things going on in the South China Sea, and China was doing stupid stuff, and he got pressed by a reporter, and he said. He said, well, do you think the United States is intimidated by this? And the reporter looked at him and he said, look, I don't want to go into, you know, a big history lesson with you, but we do have, you know, experience in the region taking islands back. And I'll leave it at that. Right? And it was like, it was awesome. It was awesome. And you don't see guys do that much, but he's got some personality. And so his public persona, I mean, to me, is pretty impressive, and obviously you don't get to be CENTCOM unless you're an impressive guy. Will, any thoughts about you know him obviously pretty well. Any thoughts about, you know, his public persona? I mean, he's a guy that's going. He's not going to stop at CENTCOM, in my opinion.
You know, smart guy has always been known as that. You don't become the MILSEC to the commandant. And then he had two big brain jobs in the joint staff. He was the J5, so your strategic plans and policy for the whole United States. And then he was a director of the joint staff, which is like the chief of staff of the joint staff. And General Dunford was a chairman. And so the chairman picks his director. And then General Dunford sent him down to CENTCOM. So I think that's a pretty good endorsement. If I remember right, as a one-star, I think he was up on the joint staff when Admiral Mullen was a chairman. And it was 2008. So it was the transition from President Bush to President Obama. And the joint staff had like a working group to work this transition. And General McKenzie there might have been two guys, or he may have been the guy who was Mullen's point man on this. And I think General Dunford at the time was a deputy in the J3. My timing might be a little bit off there, but I think that's where he became very well known in the joint community by doing that, because it was a big interagency inside the Pentagon sort of coordination for presidential transition. And again, you don't get that job unless you're a smart guy.
Right. Yeah. Right. You know, when we were at the basic school as instructors, we were being plagued by people like Bill Lind and all those Wehrmacht penis envy people. And he wrote this article, I think for the Gazette, called Flash of the Kingfisher, which, you know, was pretty prescient article. If nothing else, a great title. I don't know if you guys remember that, but,
And that's the thing. He's written in the Gazette time after time. I think it's been a while, but he used to have something in there every year or so.
No, I just say he combines that. It's interesting, Will, that you'd say, you know, General Dunford sent him to CENTCOM, but he combines a lot of General Dunford's talents, which are, you know, one, wicked smart, two, wicked savvy, three, wicked articulate, and four, it seems like, from what limited I've seen of General McKenzie, he has the ability to play the range of characters that somebody in those roles needs to play in order to be successful across different domains. And a very, very impressive guy. Let me play a couple of cuts, and we'll talk about him. And we may continue this discussion in the next week, because I'd love to hear guys like him. And I believe General Dunford was at the Aspen Security Conference either last year or the year before. And I know John Kelly was there as well. And I love to hear these, you know, smart guys in important positions in long format. We don't get to hear that enough. You hear these small sound bite out of a press conference or you know, a reporter doing a drive-by. But you don't get to hear these guys in long format talking about the complexities of a region and some of the subtleties. So the first cut I'm going to play is General McKenzie talking about American remain behind forces in Iraq. So this is him.
I do, David. You know, so our objective is we want a secure, stable, independent Iraq. And so, you know, that's the goal we share with our Iraqi partners. Yes, I think our numbers are going to get smaller, and we would want them to get smaller. As the Iraqis become more comfortable at executing operations, we can reduce our forces, and we'll do that. I don't know what that number is going to be, but there is no appetite on the part of the Iraqis for a precipitous withdrawal of U.S. forces. They don't want it because they know that we still provide very, very good support for them as they continue operations against ISIS. And ISIS, while substantially defeated, certainly as a ground-holding organization, still has the capability to pose threats in Iraq and in Syria. And there's work that yet needs to be done there. And that's work that we can help them do, not only the United States, but also our NATO and our coalition partners as we go forward.
All right. Thoughts, Will? And are you surprised that any of that?
No, and I would, you know, there's a little Politico speaking there. He checked all the blocks.
Right.
Iraqis are capable. They don't want precipitous withdrawal. NATO coalition partners. I haven't followed that stuff real closely, but when he basically puts on the table, the Iraqis don't want us to precipitously withdraw. I think that's the administration's line. I mean, it is the administration's line. I don't think he would have said it. I'm not sure there's a lot of there.
All right, Jeff, Tim.
Well, I think this, I mean, I was working, training up the task forces that were going to Anbar and to Qatim to basically provide ISR and fire support for the Iraqi units that are in Anbar province. And the difference between when ISIS walked right through Anbar and now is there's these Shia militia groups all over the face of Anbar, like measles, you know, and it'll accompany reinforced strength a couple miles from each other. And some of them are kind of, you know, belligerent with the Iraqi army. Some of them get along good with the Iraqi army. Some of them may actually be Iranians. So, but the point of it is this, that the majority Shia government of Iraq is not going to allow a gateway from people like ISIS, who are Sunni, to walk right all the way from the border at Al-Qaim to walk all the way to the gates of Baghdad like they did. And there's only a couple little hard places, extant from that, like Haditha, because they held there, but they just walk right through because it was it's Sunni land and the Sunnis weren't being treated very well. By the same token, you know, hopefully the Iraqi government is doing that, is actually has an eye towards that. We can't just continue to treat the Sunnis as like the first cousins to Saddam. You know what I mean? So. I think there's that. So I kind of agree with that too. It's what he says, pablum, it's what you got to say. But I think there's, it's pretty accurate.
Got it. Timmy, any thoughts on that?
I want to back up a little bit to how he started his speech when he had to comment on the chairman's speech, reaffirming the commitment of the military to be apolitical. A point which I don't think anybody needs to make to anybody for any reason, myself. And I want to, I'm irritated by this, because this constant saying political things and him saying in order to illustrate that we're not political. I saw that the commandant, the chairman, I don't think this General McKenzie, commented on this story about the Russian snipers in Afghanistan. Yet when I went to look to see how many of them were talking about the EFPs in Iran, what I found was this quote from incoming Chairman Joe Dunford. Listen to this. "We weren't always able to attribute the casualties that we had to Iranian activity, although many times we suspected it was the Iranian activity, even though we didn't necessarily have the forensic to support that." This is what he was saying when he's about the Iran's EFPs when he's coming in. You know that's not necessarily true, and it was immediately countered. The outgoing guy said, no, there was 500 we lost to the Iranians. So I don't like this plan addressing politics at all. He's a combatant commander. It makes me uncomfortable when he's got to go ahead and make sure everybody understands that he thinks that General Milley shouldn't have been on the church steps during the horrible photo op with Orange Man Bat. I find that irritating. And number two thing is that he seems to think that all his actions, that whether it's uncovering the IRCG coming across the bay or stripping, quote, combat capabilities from militias, he seems to think that they're getting his message he's sending and they're not attacking because they're intimidated by his overwhelming presence. I think that's a charitable assumption, and it would be the one time we've ever made assumptions about how our enemies reacted to us where we were actually correct. I wouldn't necessarily think those two are connected. I'd be much more comfortable with when you have Iranian proxy groups shelling our bases, we kill them. I think that sends a much better, unambiguous message about our intents and how annoyed we are. I don't think hitting warehouses and killing the night watchman is the way to go. That's just my personal opinion.
All right. Here's cut number two.
Sure, David. So there are actually sort of four elements to the agreement.
This is him talking about the agreement in Afghanistan. Ignatius asked him to give his assessment of how things are going.
2020. The first element is that the Taliban has to agree that they will not allow basing of Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups. in Afghanistan to operate against us. And by that, we mean principally Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The second thing is we've agreed that we would withdraw over a stated period of time if those conditions are met. Third thing is inter-Afghan negotiations will begin between the government of Afghanistan and Taliban representatives that would eventually lead to a fourth thing, which would be a ceasefire. So those are sort of the four things that are out there. And what I would tell you now is we have met our part of the agreement. We agreed to go to mid 8,000 range within 135 days. We're at that number now. So we have done that. We have also, I would note that we've agreed by May of 2021 would eventually aspirationally go to zero. We can do that, but we have noted all along that is a conditions-based approach, and conditions would have to be met that satisfy us that attacks against our homeland are not going to be generated from Afghanistan. And let me, you know, so that's not the Taliban. What that is actually, of course, Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The Taliban have no capability or actual aspiration to attack the United States, but by hosting those two other groups, they would allow those attacks to be generated. Now they've said they're, you know, they've said to varying degrees that they're going to prevent that. The jury is still very much out on that. And so we will watch the Taliban. I've said before in a couple of sessions that, look, we don't need to listen to what they say. We need to listen to what they do. And so we're watching what they do right now. And they have not yet completely made that case. There remains an opportunity for them to do it, but time is now beginning to grow short. Now, the other part of the equation is the Taliban have also are maintaining a high level of violence against Afghan military forces. They are scrupulously avoiding attacking coalition and U.S. forces, and they stayed out of the cities. But the level of violence is still too high. That level of violence needs to come down. They need to show that they're going to be willing partners to reduce it and enter into a negotiation with the government of Afghanistan. The government of Afghanistan, as you know, has gone through a rocky election process. However, they now have a president, and they have a negotiator to talk to the Taliban. So I think the government of Afghanistan is poised to begin those intra-Afghan negotiations. That is going to be a key event. That's, you know, days in the future, and that's going to be a hinge moment, I think, in the future of Afghanistan. If they can come to an agreement, if they can complete the prisoner swaps that are underway right now that are part of that, if they can come to a way forward, then we can look at what that future security environment is going to be. Look, clearly, if we have a government of Afghanistan that will complete it, that will carry out its obligations to prevent hosting entities that want to attack the West in the eastern part of Afghanistan, then we could go very small numbers in Afghanistan. I just don't know what those conditions are going to be right now. And so we're very focused on what the Taliban is doing, how they're participating in these negotiations as we go forward. The jury is still very much out. I'll pause there, David.
All right. He paused. So we'll take up the discussion. Jeff, your thoughts on his thoughts on the way forward or the current situation in Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, he never talked about Pakistan. I mean, all these Taliban guys will do in regards to people that they're shielding, we'll just have them pivot across into Waziristan. And so, and then when it gets, you know, uncomfortable there, they'll pivot back over to Afghanistan. And that's all supported by the ISI. You know, the Pakistan is a huge influence of what happens in southeastern Afghanistan. And that's the gateway to a lot of this crap. So, you know, I think David Ignatius probably, maybe he knows, I don't know, maybe not. But, you know, that General McKenzie doesn't mention that, but that's part of his area too, Pakistan. That's the reason we have issues a lot in Afghanistan. Pakistan's, it's not like not connected. Most people who are in the Taliban don't even recognize that border, you know, between the two countries. So they'll go back and forth, you know, no problem. And you know, they'll hang out in Peshawar. They'll be up there in Waziristan until, you know, it's safe. Then they'll swing back up into, you know, Kandahar province or over into Nangarhar province or a coast. I mean, you know, one of those and same type of shit. So you know, that's up. It's not just Afghanistan and just, you know, different countries and stuff. It's you know, they're connected in an uncomfortable way.
So how does that impact? So link that to what he said.
Well, he said that
he didn't talk about those things. Is that your point?
Yeah, he didn't talk about the fact that you know, the Taliban is not just in Afghanistan. The Taliban's in Pakistan. It's and that's where they that's like their Laos and Cambodia, you know, and they so that's a big part of it. And the and Pakistan, they'll just muddy the waters when they get pushed on it. I mean, for my money, after 9/11, who we should have been screwing with was Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, because they're the, you know, they're the ones that made that shit happen. People from there.
Got it. All right, Will, your thoughts?
Well, I mean, he outlines what the policy should have been in 2002. Do not support attacks on the U.S. But then he basically says, you know, we're staying until you comply with the policy. Do not support attack on the U.S. But it's not clear to me what our leverage is. And it should have been pretty clear to us in 2002 that if we put a big, medium, or whatever size footprint in there, it doesn't necessarily give us any leverage to do it, because we're not going to put the size footprint that it would have required. And so while we're watching them and we want them to do these things, I don't know what our leverage is, because as Jeff says, you know, there's this huge leak. And so it just it shows that we may have had the correct policy in 2002. You supported attacks on the U.S. We execute a punitive campaign. But then we screwed it up because we thought somehow we were going to do something to permanently change this when we didn't understand the region and know that we couldn't have permanently changed it. We can only speak softly and carry the big stick, and the big stick is going to come out once a generation or so. So I don't know what we get by having whatever footprint other than the minimal footprint it will require us to go in and punish people when they support. And it's not a, maybe it's not great because you can't necessarily prevent some catastrophic attack in the future. But it may, you know, the last 18 years may have proven to us that's the only thing we can do. So that's what I found dissatisfying about it.
Got it. Timmy?
The one thing that he right off the bat that he kept on saying was he was throwing ISIS into the equation. ISIS and Taliban, they've been fighting each other. The Taliban, when they take over, the ISIS is gone. So that's kind of weird, because I know that he knows that. And as Jeff pointed out, the whole argument about Al-Qaeda is disingenuous. They're well established in the Pakistan tribal areas. Why the hell would they go to Afghanistan? It's better to fly out of Peshawar, nicer airport. So I don't think the two things that he mentioned, ISIS and Al-Qaeda not reestablishing a footprint, I don't think that's even in the cards. What the hell would they do that for? They've got no reason to, because the Taliban can do plenty of that on its own. The other problem is the incentive right now is for them to keep fighting. If the Taliban suddenly stopped all attacks against the government and there was no fighting going on, I don't know what the hell the military is going to do. How would they keep their money train flowing? It would be a disaster for them. So I don't think there's any incentive for anybody to stop fighting, because as long as they're battling in all four directions of the compass, they can make a case that we need to get our salaries paid, because we're doing that right now. Only thing keeping them alive is our donor money. And right now, the only thing that Afghanistan does is fight. That's how they get the money. That's what they're reduced to. So this is not going to end anytime soon. This is going to drag out for a long time. And they better move that damn embassy up to the Bagram airfield and get it the hell out of Kabul, or we're going to have issues when that thing ultimately crumbles.
Yeah, interesting.
I'm telling you. I'm telling you.
Here's him talking about China and Russia in CENTCOM, which I thought was kind of interesting.
So let me talk about Russia and China, but I'll begin with Russia, because that's the actual core of your question. I think Russia's presence in the theater is actually fairly narrow. It's in Syria. And, you know, they're in Syria because it's an old client state of theirs. They held basing there throughout the entire period of the Cold War. They have very, very, very few public international client states. This is one. So it's very important to them. You know, I've said earlier that I don't view the Russians as master chess players who have a plan for everything and see forward into deep time to know what to do. I think they opportunistically stumbled into this thing in Syria. it gives them an opportunity to try to support a client state, maintain warm water basing in the Mediterranean, which has been a long-term goal of them militarily and diplomatically. It allows them to throw sand in our gearbox and try to assert themselves as a player in the Middle East. I'm not certain that's going to work out for them in the long term, because I'm not certain that their economy, the base of their economy, which is not particularly large and is declining in many ways, is going to support that. You know, we don't see them a lot further east in the region. You know, we don't see them up in the Gulf. We don't see them in other places, and they struggle to maintain deployments even into the Mediterranean and even into Syria. So Syria has been a useful place for them on a very narrow scope and scale to showcase systems and to pronounce their military effectiveness. But I don't think they've shown a larger capability to move beyond that. So, and I will leave Libya alone. It's one of the few places in the world, actually, where I am not directly involved. So I will leave others to discuss Libya. But I would like to talk about China for just a moment.
Please.
And so the threat from China, the issue with China right now is more economic than military. China seeks to move into the theater and is moving into the theater in a variety of ways through some of the pernicious debt traps that they lay out for nations to gain basing access. We see it in Djibouti right now. We see other nations in the region that are talking to them. China wants to do export of military sales. The problem China has, though, is their equipment's just not very good. And while there are no end user agreements associated with their equipment, they could care less what you do with it. Still, at the end of the day, it's Chinese equipment. And it's not as good as equipment that they could purchase from us or other people as well. China sees the mineral riches in the region, and China is interested in moving in the long term to get after that in Afghanistan and other places. And they've made some attempts before in Afghanistan that were not wholly successful. But going forward, I think the larger, if we were to say great power competition in the theater, a great power competition in the theater in the long term is going to be with China more so than Russia, although I would never completely discount Russia. But I think we look at that very hard. And as we redistribute our forces, we want to assure our allies and partners that we're going to be with them, that we're going to continue to support them, even as we change the nature of the relationship in the theater.
Thoughts on that? I thought him pointing out the Chinese thirst and desire for minerals around the world is pretty interesting. But Jeff, your thoughts on his thoughts on Russia and China in CENTCOM.
Yeah. I listened to all those things you sent to us in that email. So I listened to this before. And what struck me then and strikes me even more now is kind of like related to the whole force design thing that's going on right now. I mean, we might be rethinking our Afghanistan footprint with an eye towards countering China. I mean, we're already in there. You know, you have to worry about the second island chain from Afghanistan, you know, and, places like Afghanistan and India, you know, that have land that touch China in a place they're really not paying too much attention to, you know, vis-a-vis the United States might be, not a bad way to go, so, you know, especially since we're used to going there. And, I don't know, but that's what kind of jumped out at me as he was talking about it, because he's clearly not, he doesn't think the Chinese are as formidable as apparently some other people, at least in the higher ranks of the Marine Corps, do, because of this, the drastic and dramatic changes being wrought through the force design over the next 10 years. Now, from what he's saying, they're not that daunting, you know, the Chinese. So that's what kind of jumped out at me from what he's saying.
Got it. Timmy, your thoughts?
You know, the one thing that he didn't mention, and one of those hot topics we were talking about a year ago, was when we abandoned the Kurds to their fate because the Turks came across the border. Remember all the concern about that and how bad we were? And it turned out that everything kind of settled down. The Kurds took care of – the Kurds were never that vulnerable. It's just interesting how many problems we've addressed on a show are no longer problems. They just kind of solve themselves. And the – point I made back then about the Turks, welcome to the game of trying to throw influence in an area that you're not from, is what the general was talking about there. You know, the sortie rates, yeah, the Chinese and some other nations are getting out there with the blue water, But keeping sortie rates up, that's a very, very difficult task, as we well know. And they've got problems with basic chain of custody honesty. I mean, you think we've got problems with the Fat Leonard thing. How do you think the Chinese are doing as far as their contracts to keep their ships up and running? So it's interesting to hear him acknowledge that there's a lot of people that have bitten off a bit more than they're digested and able to chew, to include the Iranians. And I'm always happy to hear that.
Got it. Will, thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting, you know, that maybe you can see the Chinese are not expeditionary like we are, worldwide expeditionary. And so CENTCOM, the heart of CENTCOM in the Gulf is a long ways from China. And so they may be putting out some feelers there, but they're attacking it more economically. And I would suspect they're a lot more capable, sort of South China Sea, close expeditionary type of thing. And it's just sort of an interesting formulation. Hadn't really thought about it until I really listened to what he was saying, that they get an economic dependency at distance that maybe is going to grow into more Chinese influence than they have more secure basing or something to be able to do things, as opposed to completely expeditionary, which they're just not capable of doing now, as opposed to, you know, we can put forces out and sustain them around the world. There's no one else that can do that. So interesting looking at maybe Chinese strategy a little bit differently. And I think his comments about Russia are absolutely on. You know, they are they're a fading sort of force, dangerous, whatever, 10,000 nuclear weapons, but they're fading. And it's hard to believe anyone willingly thinks, well, if I want a partner, I'm going to go to Russia. Those are people that are trying to partner up with Russia are those are sort of last gasp sort of things, because what is Russia besides a gangster state? You know, 40 years ago they had ideology, maybe, but now they're gangsters, and so no one wants to sign on for that unless they're desperate. So I thought that was interesting.
There's a Chinese presence in East Africa too. You know, not military so much as, like you were saying, Will. You know,
right, the whole. You know, the whole economic presence that, you know, and we'll give you, you know, whatever you need, infrastructure, weapons, whatever, sign these documents. If you default, we'll take this stuff over. And that's the game they play. So interesting. All right. All right. What are you reading, Will?
Yeah, let me pull up. I finished that book on the Holocaust, and, we've talked about it for like 3 weeks now. Just highly recommend it. A lot of detail in there that's painful to go through, but is probably good for all of us to really understand. And I'm looking. Sorry, I gotta pull up my app here. I'm reading a book now. It's called Common Sense Nation. And so it's like an analysis of the founding documents as seen through how the founders came up with a philosophy based on English Enlightenment, the French Enlightenment, the Scottish Enlightenment, and how they genuinely thought, and what are the roots of how they tried to build the country. And it's he's analyzing many other people's writings and sort of amalgamating it. And I like to think I've read a lot about this stuff, but I've been learning things. And when you say Common Sense Nation, it's not like the way you and I think of common sense. It's a philosophical term of art back then. Think Thomas Paine, Common Sense, but it really shows the genius of the people to understand the time they were in, the people they were in, the opportunity they had to build a lasting government. And they saw everything that's going on today. They saw these things, and they really tried to prevent them in the way they framed up Constitution, the way they analyzed it in the Federalist Papers and then the founding document, the Declaration of Independence. So I'm about halfway into it, and it's intellectual reading, so it's a little bit slow. Right. And you gotta, you know, as Mac would say, you gotta go to the footnotes as well. But
only if you want to get something out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I've actually reread the Declaration of Independence twice while I'm reading this book. So interesting. Yeah. Common Sense Nation. You can look it up, Mac. You're faster than I am at this stuff. Yeah. Common Sense Nation by where's the title page? Sorry, guys. By Robert Curry, C-U-R-R-Y.
There you got it. Tim, what are you reading these days?
Well, you know, I'm not battling a gaming addiction, so I don't have to lose myself in these theoretical tomes. I can actually enjoy a book, a story from a peer. And what I have is an advanced reader's copy of The Wolves of Helmand from Frank Gus Biggio. That's B-I-G-G-I-O. I'm sure I didn't say that right. Who was a guy, was an infantry officer, did his time as reservist, got out in the late 90s, went to law school, was married a doctor, was working in D.C., doing pretty well because when he was getting ready to come back in Marine Corps and out practicing running with his infant son in a harness, his neighbor Michelle would come by and chat with him every morning. And in 2008, she went to the White House with her husband Barack. So he was coming in a good neighborhood. And by 2003, he couldn't take it, and he joined reserves to go as a civil affairs platoon. And he went to the Helmand to Nawa with 1-5 in 2009. And I met him in Nawa. That's why I got the book, because we knew each other. I just met him briefly there. But it's a great story about an interesting aspect of the Afghan war. When I met Frank, he said he not only did he know the name of every farmer in around Nawa, in every family, he knew the names of their damn goats and cows. He knew exactly which compound every cow belonged in. That was how much those guys got around. That was it's an impressive story of an effort that we could have never sustained for any length of time, but was damn impressive when it was being sustained. I can tell you that much.
And what's
impressive.
So what's the name of the book, and how do you spell it?
The name of the book is The Wolves of Helmand. A View from Inside the Den of Modern War. The author's name is Frank Gus, B-I-G-G-I-O. And he writes a good damn story. You know, the guy was making the bucks and just couldn't stand it. Went over as a civil affairs guy, right into the shit. Gotta admire that.
Nice, nice. Yeah. All right, Jeff, what are you reading?
Well, I was reading this book called The Real Lincoln. When I went to the change of command, then I had to go up to Pittsburgh. That was kind of a all-encompassing thing. And I'm too lazy to even try and carry a book in my backpack now when I go on a flight. So I just take my Kindle. So I started reading it again when I got back. And what's interesting, it kind of like dovetails what Will was saying about the book he was reading, and that a lot of these guys prior to the Civil War, and the reason we had the Civil War, they believed in the Constitution, but they didn't think the Declaration of Independence was like a worthwhile document. And so I end up reading it again myself, you know, and then like John C. Calhoun and some of the guys, like, it's interesting because it shows the political speeches and stuff a lot of these guys were making in the 1850s. Like, for instance, Jefferson Davis was anti-secessionist up until about 4 years before the Civil War. It's incredible. You know, and then he ends up as president of the Confederacy. And so it's and also it kind of puts Lincoln in a little bit more cynical light. So, you know, some of it, you know, you got to, I'm really reading it carefully, but pretty interesting, you know, pretty interesting.
Got it. All right. Boys, first of all, I appreciate your time this week, and I want to wish you all the best of luck. And we might. There's a couple of things about that Mackenzie says that we didn't get to today that I'd like to get to. So we might start with that next time. So Will, good luck with your dog and your gambling addiction, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
Take care, man.
See you guys.
All right. Yep. There you have it, the Mensa sisters here on a Thursday.
That from happening was
that's General Mackenzie. He's not involved with them, so yeah, don't get him confused with one of the Mensa sisters. That'll do it. In the first hour today, I talk about all Fat Man Radio that I did, and guys who replaced me. At least one of the hours was known as A Ton of Fun at One. Talk about that. Talk about my need for a movie and software that can help me create such a thing. So if you know of good software that produces movies, let me know. I'm trying to create a couple. And then we take a real quick look at the news headlines. Yeah. Kind of hour one's a little bit of all personality radio. So have a great day. First virtual performance of Post-Traumatic Winning happens here shortly. So, looking forward to it. Anyway, have a great day. Do not be afraid to go change somebody's life. If my life now means anything, it's a statement of if you're persistent and you'll look up footnotes and you're intellectually inquisitive, right, you can be a lifelong learner. And if you've ever been through traumatic shit, if you'll just look at people and say, could I talk to you? That's all it takes to change somebody's life. So go do that. And if you know somebody you're supposed to talk to and you procrastinated, stop procrastinating. Get off your ass and do that. Right? Because you never know, right? You simply never know when somebody needs your help. And so it's just sticking that hand out and saying, hey, man. How about we have a conversation? I'd like to help you. So don't be afraid to do that. So on a Thursday, All Marine Radio. And that's why this high life thing, right? Right? Change somebody's life so they can live the high life. And you will live a higher life for helping them get to the high life. That's why this song gets played. On a Thursday, All Marine Radio, over and out.